On this episode of Skeptico, Alex talks with Victor and Wendy Zammit about their new book, A Lawyer Presents the Evidence for the Afterlife.
Let me share another quote from the book that I think gets at this. It strikes home with me because, as I mentioned to you in my email, my wife is a forensic psychologist and gives testimony in court on her expertise and is just grilled by the other side, as is appropriate. But here's what you and Wendy write in the book. When materialist scientists attack scientists and others who support the paranormal, the materialists do not allow their prejudices to be examined in public, testing the credibility, the prejudices, and the degree of expertise of an expert witness through cross-examination is another role of attorneys.
Well, the thing is, Alex, in the legal process situation and a cross-examination, the witness has to answer the question. This is very, very important. In a courtroom situation, I'd have to ask, as I said before, I ask the question, in a simple question, what afterlife evidence you came across you do not agree with? I have 24 different areas of afterlife evidence to present. Not just one. This is like the prosecutor having 24 witnesses in a murder case.
Stay with us for Skeptico.
Welcome to Skeptico, where we explore controversial science with leading researchers, thinkers, and their critics. I'm your host, Alex Sakaris, and on this episode, I talk with a gentleman who, if you've been following the skeptical movement for any time at all, you've probably run into. That is Victor Zammit. He's a fascinating guy, a longtime attorney in Australia, who along with his wife Wendy has done a lot of research into some of these topics. They've just published a new book, and I thought it was a great time to have him on. Here's my dialogue with Victor and Wendy Zammit. Today we welcome Victor and Wendy Zammit to Skeptico. Victor is a lawyer with a distinguished legal career in Australia, but is probably known to most of you as an articulate advocate of near-death experience science and for being a thorn in the side of skeptics and status quo scientists. That's what Victor is known for. Wendy Zammit, who has an advanced degree in psychology, has, along with Victor, published a new book titled A Lawyer Presents the Evidence for the Afterlife. Now, you might have heard of this book before, but it's just out in finished form, and you really need to check it out on Amazon or any of your favorite booksellers. They're here today to tell us about the book. Victor, Wendy, welcome. Thanks so much for joining me on Skeptico.
Good to be here, Alex.
Lovely to be here with you, Alex.
Great. Well, the approach that you've taken in this book, in particular you, Victor, as the title suggests, is one of a lawyer.
Yes.
Why does that perspective need to be brought to the table? Isn't this something for science really to hammer out? We're talking about scientific evidence of the afterlife. Shouldn't we leave this up to the scientists?
Well, Alex, a big problem with scientists is that they can hide their prejudices. They can hide their partiality. There's a huge difference, a fundamental difference between scientific process and the legal process when we're dealing with the afterlife.
This is a quote from your book that I thought was particularly good, and it struck me as something that really does uniquely qualify lawyers, attorneys, barristers to look at this. This is from your book. You say, much of the evidence for the afterlife depends on the testimony of witnesses who claim to have had direct experiences of it. Assessing their credibility, examining their character, stability, reputations, and motives is a standard task for attorneys. I think that's an interesting point, because scientists seem to fumble over this time and time again that, oh my gosh, you can't trust people, you can't trust their experiences. And of course, that always strikes us as, well, of course we can. We do that all the time. We do that every day. And then you bring it even further and say that lawyers are particularly skilled at doing that. So what do you think about that?
You just said it.
Alex, I'd like to come in here on that one. when we look at what scientists can actually do, so much of the evidence these days is coming to ordinary people. So much of the things, when we're talking about near-death experiences, when we're talking out-of-body experiences, when we're talking about after-death contacts. And as we said, in a courtroom, this is the lawyer's job. The lawyer's job is to try and work out what is this person's motive, how credible are they, do they have sufficient objectivity. And I would agree with Victor on this one, that these are definitely skills that an experienced courtroom lawyer has.
Well, I think you both do an excellent job in the book of laying out that argument in a very structured, easy-to-follow way that winds up being very compelling. And I think when we contrast that with the skeptical position, it just needs to be brought out and examined, because for the longest time, I think that the skeptics, their basic position is, reminds me of the old Groucho Marx quote, you know, who are you going to believe, me or your lying eyes? You know, so we have these people who say, hey, I really had this experience, and the scientists are coming along and saying, no, you didn't, because of this and because of this and because of that. And we look at these people and we say, wait a minute, these people in every other aspect of their life are believable, trustworthy, reliable, know if they're really having this experience or not. Why would we not believe them here? So it's kind of an interesting situation. Let me share another quote from the book that I think gets at this in another way, and it strikes home with me because, as I mentioned to you in my email, my wife is a forensic psychologist and gives testimony in court on her expertise and is just grilled by the other side, as is appropriate. But here's what you and Wendy write in the book. When materialist scientists attack scientists and others who support the paranormal, the materialists do not allow their prejudices to be examined in public, testing the credibility, the prejudices, and the degree of expertise of an expert witness through cross-examination is another role of attorneys, because they know that the outcome of many trials depends on the testimony of such an expert witness. Tell us about this cross-examination process and what you think would be revealed if we had the opportunity to cross-examine some of these folks who are so dead set against, pardon the pun, near-death experience science.
Well, the thing is, Alex, in the legal process situation and a cross-examination, the witness has to answer the question. This is very, very important. In a courtroom situation, I'd have to ask, as I said before, I ask the question, in a simple question, what afterlife evidence you came across you do not agree with? I have 24 different areas of afterlife evidence to present. Not just one. This is like the prosecutor having 24 witnesses in a murder case. Now, why should the prosecutor call only one witness when he can call 24 witnesses?
Well, very good. And Victor and Wendy, let's go over a couple of those eyewitnesses that you have in A Lawyer Presents the Evidence for the Afterlife. That you have quite a few, as you mentioned. A couple of them jumped out at me that I wanted to share with the audience and kind of get your additional feedback on. So, number 10, some people have group near-death experiences. So, here we're talking about maybe a group of people that all have the same experience. Tell us about that and why that's important.
Well, I'll come in on that one. The one that I can think of is the group of firefighters who they were all unconscious at the same time in a fire, and they got to the other side. And when they came back, they actually shared the things that had happened on the other side. To me, this is really interesting, and particularly why I like this area of evidence is it's also been repeated in the Monroe Institute experiments. You're probably aware, Alex, of that Robert Monroe had he worked with groups of explorers who would go out of their body and would coordinate and would meet out of their body and then would come back and they would discuss exactly what had happened. Mm-hmm. To me, that kind of verification is absolutely mind-blowing.
I think it is too, you know, and it's also a research interest of Dr. Raymond Moody, of course, who really pioneered this whole field and this idea of group near-death experiences. So I think you're really onto something there. Let's move on to number 11. Some people have near-death experiences when there's nothing physically wrong with them. It's interesting because when I've talked to skeptics, they sometimes want to turn this around and say, well, gee, not everyone has the same symptoms or the same medical condition when they have a near-death experience. And really, I mean, that's more evidence for the unique medical mystery that this really is. But tell us more.
Well, I'll come in on that one as well, because my particular interest is in peak experiences. And if you go right back to Abraham Maslow, he was really into this sort of thing. And Charles Tart has put together the website TASTE, which is about scientists who have these experiences of expanded consciousness, which are virtually the same as many of the near-death experiences. There are so many accounts of people who have just had absolutely spontaneously had the same experiences as near-death experiences. You can find these on Kevin Williams' website, neardeath.com. He has literally case after case after case, people just sitting down to meditate, and they find themselves having an out-of-body experience, a mystical experience, an experience of expanded consciousness, which is virtually the same thing. So we clearly, it is not just a brain misfunction.
Right. And obviously what we're contrasting this with is the important medical work that's been done in hospital that shows that people who are brain dead, and we know that because they've many times have suffered a cardiac arrest and are being resuscitated and there hasn't been any blood flow to the brain. So we have this situation where people have no brain activity. They are brain dead. We know they're brain dead. And yet they're experiencing something that's very similar to these people who are having these peak experiences with no medical emergency. So it really is quite a mystery. And at the very least, it certainly falsifies this theory that you are this biological robot that is purely a function of your brain. That just doesn't hold anymore when you look at this evidence, does it?
Not only that, I mean, you mentioned the experiences when the brain is dead. I mean, the classic case for that, of course, is the Pam Reynolds case. I mean, I quite accept what happened there when Pam Reynolds, the surgeons were able to stop the brain from functioning, they stopped the heart from beating. She was dead for one full hour, and yet she had a full-blown near-death experience. I mean, that shows that near-death experiences are real.
Wendy, you mentioned a minute ago Dr. Charles Tart, who I think has done some fantastic work in this area. He wrote an excellent book a few years ago titled The End of Materialism, and he lays out very convincingly the evidence for what a lot of people call psi, telepathy, clairvoyance, precognition, all these things that sometimes fall into this category, and we just lump them together and call them psi. Why is that important for your case for an afterlife? Because you do include that in the book. What is the connection there?
Okay, well, the whole point is that PSI, basically, when we're looking at clairvoyance, communication, telepathy, when you are working with mediums, all mediums have, first of all, have to have very good abilities in telepathy and clairvoyance. They have to be able to have those psychic abilities as a baseline. And what we are arguing is that they're the same abilities, except that the abilities are directed to a different dimension. If we can show through laboratory experiments, as we have done, that PSI abilities exist, then it's a first step to understanding how these abilities are then used in a slightly different direction.
Let me switch gears only slightly here, because you also talk about in the book remote viewing, and you remind us of this rather amazing quote from former United States President Jimmy Carter that he gave in an interview, and here's what he said. He said, he witnessed a session where this remote viewer went into a trance, and he says, while she was in a trance, she gave us some longitude and latitude figures. We focused our satellite cameras on that point, and the lost plane was there. So here, first of all, this is astounding because in a number of respects, but one of the ways it's astounding is that we've had this misinformation, disinformation campaign for the longest time against Psi. And it's always come down to, well, no, it doesn't. We never really did it. It was never really successful. And here we have the highest ranking government official in the United States coming out and say, yeah, it was real. I was right there.
Right, yeah.
And I observed it. How can we really approach this whole area of the limits of consciousness when we have this official wall of skeptical nonsense that's out there?
Rupert Sheldrake was very interesting on this. He said quite recently that science is becoming schizophrenic. And I love the way he talked about this, that the vast majority of people, and as he was saying, have had experiences of telepathy, of after-death contacts. And what's happening is science is actually coming into disrepute because so many people are saying, look, I don't care what you say, I have had these experiences and I know that they're real. And more, I'm in our research, we're finding that more and more people are really going with their own experiences rather than listening to scientists.
Yeah, I totally second that. Actually, I tell you this, Alex, I experienced remote viewing myself, and nobody can tell me it doesn't exist. My readings, our readings, Wendy and I, we read about this in a great deal. We find China is more, I'd say China is more advanced in remote viewing than any other country in the world today.
Yeah, and that opens up a whole bunch of other areas. Let me throw out another little story about that. I had a chance to interview Joe McGonigal, who, psychic spy number one for the United States as part of the Stargate program that a lot of people know about. But a lot of people don't know that he's also a near-death experiencer. He had his near-death experience while he was an army intelligence officer in East Germany, and it was probably the result of an assassination attempt. But what was interesting is he comes out of this near-death experience, classic near-death experience. He's above his body. Yeah. He doesn't even know what's going on. Sees his mates drive him to the hospital and bang down the door. Then he has this extraordinary divine experience, this meeting with what he feels like is God. And he comes out of this, and he's immediately interrogated by Army intelligence because that's his job, and they want to know everything that happened. And he tells them the whole story about his near-death experience. Now, here's what's interesting. Fast forward a few years later, he's sent to Stanford Research Institute, where Russell Targ and Hal Puthoff are doing these remote viewing projects. And here's the part that I thought was amazing. He says they go into his permanent file, his military file, and they pull out this sealed thing that says not to be opened by anyone except the commander of intelligence. And therein is the report of his near-death experience and a copy of Raymond Moody's book, Life After Death.
Right.
Now, what this tells me and how it relates to what we're both talking about here is that the military knew about the reality of near-death experience, knew its connection to psychic experience and extended human consciousness, and yet to connect it back to our skeptical friends, when they wanted to kind of put out the disinformation campaign, they went and hired a skeptic, like they hired Ray Hyman from University of Oregon, to write this report and say that Stargate, it never happened, it never produced any results. So, you know, back to this point of how can we ever really get to the bottom of this when there is such an organized, orchestrated effort to disinform, to misinform people about the reality of this?
Well, as I said before, the scientists who are targeting the paranormal researchers are getting funded by big corporations. It's in the interest of big corporations not to allow this paranormal to be accepted by people everywhere.
And I think, Alex, you're onto something about a paid disinformation campaign. I mean, we're seeing now very clearly that there has been a very serious disinformation campaign about UFOs, and it would not surprise us if that was extended to the whole of psychic phenomena. Obviously, they don't want people to know just how powerful this is.
Yeah, and I've always thought that some people take that too far and think that there's some smoky room where all these people are making these decisions. I don't think it really has to go that way. There's enough people who are naturally inclined, as you point out in the book, and we'll talk about that in a minute, to have a strong bias against this because it so contradicts their worldview that it really doesn't take much for someone to shape this information in a particular way, nudge it this way, nudge it that way.
As
far as pushing it, I mean, I think at the simplest level, these folks are interested in defending the status quo. I mean, they just don't want change. Even if they aren't sure what the change would be, they're like, let's just kind of keep the wheels on the track here and keep things moving along so we can continue doing what we do. But I want to totally switch gears for a minute and talk about a topic that I think is a little bit harder to wrestle down because I don't know if we're in total sync on this. And you mentioned in your book that your book is not religious. But at the same point, you know, religion plays such a dominant role in Western culture. And I hear from people in Europe all the time and they go, no, no, no. And I always say, gee, you know, if you fail to see how deeply ingrained the Judeo-Christian, Islamic, Abrahamic tradition is in everything we do, then you're just not paying attention. So given all that, can we really ignore the religious implications of what NDEs are telling us?
Oh, look, I'm not saying in the book that we should ignore religion. I'm not saying that religions are wrong about the afterlife. I never said that. As a matter of fact, I had a Catholic priest saying, gee, that's great that you are giving some presenting scientific proof that the afterlife exists. This is great for us because it makes us feel good. We have now proof that the afterlife does exist. It's not just theory, not just belief.
Alex, let me come in on this one. I think what we take in the book is the fact that all religions began with psychic phenomena. And these things, the near-death experiences, out-of-body experiences, mystical experiences, mediumship, these were the naturally occurring things which came about and which people then codified into the various religions. But if we go back to the actual experiences which generated these religions, I believe we can go back to those, and those are occurring today, not just in the past.
Fair enough, and I would agree with you. I just think we also have to be upfront in acknowledging that there are a lot of people who are going to find conflict with the near-death experience science, approaching it just head-on like you are without whitewashing it or trying to fit it one way or another, and their religious beliefs. I mean, this blows out of the water the primacy of Christianity. Forget it. If you think Christianity is the only way to experience the divine, then you are not going to be comfortable with the body of near-death experience. It just directly contradicts that. There's no way around it.
There's something most fundamental that what one has to accept, that mediums for centuries have told us that we have a duplicate body of our physical body. We have a duplicate spiritual etheric body, so that when we cross over, the physical body dies and it's burnt like an old coat, right? But the etheric spiritual body continues and in the afterlife. Now that's very important because this is what NDE is about, that with that spiritual, that etheric spiritual body comes out of the physical body when there is a near-death experience.
Wendy, did you want to add anything to that?
I think you're talking about fundamentalist Christians, the kind of people who really believe that anything other than Christianity is not worth anything. But I think you'll find that the majority of Christians these days are taking a much broader view.
Yeah, I really
think the fundamentalists are in a minority.
Well, I wish that were true. That's not been my experience. You know,
maybe that's your experience. Certainly,
I have to tell you. I mean, I live in a very liberal part of the United States in Southern California, and up until about a year ago, we used to attend. Me and my family used to attend a local Presbyterian, kind of very mainstream liberal Protestant denomination. Even though we're not Christians, I just think God shows up, you know, wherever you want. But no, they are not. they are not, as a whole, open. They are very locked into certain values, certain beliefs, into the inerrancy of Scripture. So, yeah, it's nice to think that, but I really think that the majority of Christians would be welcoming in a very selective way of the near-death experience message. And I think there's another level beyond that in terms of doing the kind of work that y'all have done in your book and really getting down to expanding our view of what consciousness is and being willing to go all the different places that you go in terms of, you know, what about mediumship, like you talk so much about in the book? What about this remote viewing, this and these other psychic abilities? I think there's a lot of people that are still reluctant to go there, or even the UFO phenomena, which I think is somehow related to this extended human consciousness that we're talking about. Again, as you move further and further out, I think you narrow down the audience among the believer crowd that are willing to go there.
My experience is not so much with Protestant religion, the extreme. It's more with Catholics. And a huge number of Catholics have become very, very comfortable with mediumship. It's really interesting if you actually look at the number of Catholics. I'm talking about people like John Edward, some of the other mediums who are very, very comfortable moving between mediumship and Catholicism. It's amazing how many people within the Catholic Church happily go to Mass on Sunday and then go along to a spiritualist service or go along and consult a medium during the week.
Finally, I want to return to the topic of the skeptics because, yes, Victor, you have been a tireless critic of the skeptical nonsense that we've seen. And one of the things that I came across on your website, which you do have an excellent website at victorzamet.com, but was the 9 reasons why it's a waste of time to argue with close-minded skeptics. And I got quite a kick out of this. And again, we can't go over all 9, but I did want to touch on 2 of them, number 1 and number 9. Let's start with number 1, rationalization through cognitive dissonance. And you know what intrigues me here is, you know, this idea of cognitive dissonance is something that gets thrown around a lot, but it's really very real in a way that people don't understand. I have experienced this myself in interviewing some very well-known, well-credentialed scientists who just freak out when they're really confronted with evidence that challenges their worldview. Tell us about your experience with this.
Yeah, well, cognitive dissonance is a defense. When a person has deeply entrenched beliefs, let's say a skeptic, deeply entrenched beliefs that there is no afterlife, for example. Now, if I come along and explain to him the evidence for the afterlife, 24 of them, which people found it impossible to rebut, that what happens to that skeptic? He tries to rationalize his beliefs. This is because the information he's getting from me, which is fundamentally inconsistent with his own cherished beliefs, will speed up his blood pressure. He starts to sweat. Anxiety sets in. And to offset this anxiety, the skeptic will try to rationalize, saying, oh, you can't be right. You can't be right because, you know, all my life I didn't believe in this. And, I can't be wrong. So this anxiety, this intense anxiety, the skeptic thinks he can remove it by rationalizing, trying to delude himself what he believes in is correct.
Well, moreover, this is something that we all experience if we're honest about it. And I, you know, regretfully can look back at times when, you know, I think I'm a pretty open-minded person, but there's been times when this is just how we're all wired. You know, we're all navigate through these complicated lives that we have, and we think we do a pretty good job at it. So we're pretty well wed to these ideas and beliefs that we have. And it's no wonder that when they're challenged, we kind of freak out a little bit.
It depends entirely how open a person is to new information. But there are reasons for some people to be aggressive against the paranormal. As I said before, I gave nine reasons. You have those. One of the number six is about the primary motivation, and perhaps it's for money, power, status, and the job sometimes.
And, you know, I think that's an interesting one, but I think that is often a subconscious motivation in that, you know, they've run through the formula and how this works and what it would mean to really take this other position. And they don't even have to bring it up to a conscious level to know that's not going to be good for them. But I'll tell you, the last one I wanted to hit on because I got a kick out of it is number nine, you say, is being spiritually retarded. Tell us about that. What do you mean?
Well, we do a lot of research, and there's a very spiritually advanced teacher from the afterlife, very, very highly credible teacher, who says that those skeptics may not be spiritually advanced enough for them to understand what is going on about the afterlife.
And you point out in the book or on the website, this is on your website, that you just don't mean religious or spiritual in the traditional sense. You mean just a certain kind of openness that we can't quite put our finger on why people are more open in that way, but some people are, and some people are just totally shut down to any kind of experience that is outside of their immediate kind of here and now life.
That's right. And there's one thing I'd like to remind your listeners, and especially those skeptics, is that we have the evidence, the absolute irrefutable evidence that consciousness survives. That's no question about that, right? We know where we're heading. And we have some of the most brilliant and most intelligent scientists who, after they investigated, conceded. They said, yes, they were open-minded enough to say, yes, the afterlife, yeah, we accept it, right? But there isn't one scientist, one closed-minded scientist, who wrote a book saying why the afterlife cannot exist. There isn't one genius closed-minded skeptic to show that the afterlife cannot exist. You know, we have hundreds and hundreds of books by very intelligent scientists why they accepted the afterlife. And yet there isn't one book.
Well, counselor, I'd say that's a pretty good summary closing argument. Wendy, tell us what else folks might find in A Lawyer Presents the Evidence for the Afterlife. And tell us a little bit about the website as well, victorzammit.com, because I know you are involved heavily both in the writing of the book and in maintaining the website and the newsletter that y'all put out.
Thanks, Alex. Well, yes, one of the things about the book is we tried to write it in plain English without any technical terms. We deliberately kept in mind that many of our readers these days are coming from languages other than English. And so we've tried to have short sentences. The other thing in the book is we've started off with the common experiences that people have. Things that people will talk about, and people are talking much more about those experiences of after-death contacts, how to recognize an after-death contact, how to help somebody who's had a near-death experience. All of those very, very frequently experienced things like deathbed visions and how they can help people who are dying. The website itself has a lot more research-based, and we have assembled a lot of videos to make it easier for people to actually see the experimenters. I think when you see people on video, you can get a sense of their credibility. You get more information than just watching, reading what they have said. The book is available now, of course, as you mentioned, on Amazon.com. But the other thing we'd like to mention to people is that we have an earlier version of the book on the website, which is available free of charge that they can download. The other thing on the website is they can sign up for our weekly Friday report. Every Friday we send out a report on the latest research and interesting topics on paranormal and afterlife research, which has links to a lot of videos. We have thousands of people from all over the world subscribe to that report, and they get a great deal out of it.
Well, great. It's wonderful work that you've done, and I really appreciate the book. I think it's very nicely done. I encourage anyone. Obviously, it's free and available on the website, but you can also grab a copy and give it to someone and really open them up to this. Victor, Wendy, thank you both so much for joining me today on Skeptico.
Great.
Thank you, Alex.
Thanks for that, Alex.
Thanks again to Victor and Wendy Zammit for joining me today on Skeptico. I have a couple of questions I might tee up as a result of this interview. The first has to do with Victor's legal approach to these issues, and it strikes me as having a certain truth to it. I mentioned in the lead-in the part about expert witness, and I think that really is an important part of the near-death experience as well as these other experiences that science often throws up their arms and says, gee, we can't get our arms around these. These are anecdotal. And it always struck me as being completely out of sync with the way that our society operates. I mean, we trust or don't trust people in every walk of life, in politics, certainly in the legal system, as Victor points out. And we seem to have honed our skills pretty well at deciding what accounts are reasonable, what accounts are true. And we have all sorts of systems, even social science systems, to determine that. So let's probe into that a little bit and re-examine the role that witness testimony might play in answering some of these questions. The second question I tee up has to do with government involvement, and we just kind of stumbled across this in the interview, but I think it's very significant to again go back and revisit the account of former U.S. President Jimmy Carter, where he walks in on a remote viewing session, one that turned out to be extraordinarily successful and impossible to explain in normal means. So there's so many parts to this, but one, there was an active program, two, it was getting results, and then three, most importantly, we have to square that with the fact that we live with a position of official denial on this. I think that impossible to resolve contradiction between the official story and the reality of how psi is used in our military, in our government, is something that I'd like to probe. So I guess the question would be, what do you make of that? How involved are U.S. and other governments in the application of these kinds of extended human consciousness, including psi, that we've talked about? So if you'd like to weigh in on any of those questions or other questions, the place to do that is the Skeptico website. It's at skeptiko.com. You'll find a comment section there or a link to the forum, which is quite popular, and you can pop over and join a dialogue over there. Of course, while you're at the website, you can also check out our over 200 previous episodes of Skeptico, all available for free download from the website and through iTunes. Well, that's going to do it for this episode. Have a number of interesting projects and interviews in the works. I hope you'll stay with me for all of that. Until next time, take care. Bye for now.